We've been waiting for you. Come on in. It's Talk 10 Tuesday with Chuck Buck and Dr. Erica Reamer. Today, senior healthcare consultant Barry Stanfill covers the impending arrival of ICD-11 to the USA. Susan Gatehouse reports on the FDA decision on the drug treatment for Alzheimer's. Plus, we'll hear the latest coding news from Lori Johnson. Dr. John Zellum is at the Tuesday News Desk, and Dr. Reamer presents her talkback segment. Now, here's the publisher of ICD-10 Monitor, the host of Talk 10 Tuesday, and man who thinks 5G is an awful lot to pay for a new phone, Chuck Buck.
Thank you, 5G. Yeah, I'd love to have some 5G. Thank you very much, Clark Anthony. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 496th live edition of Talk 10 Tuesday, and good morning, Erica.
Good morning, Chuck, and good morning, everyone.
Well, Erica, once again, we find ourselves talking about the elephant in the room.
Yes, you're talking, of course, about ICD-11.
That's right. A couple of weeks ago, the World Health Organization, the WHO, brought ICD-11 online.
Who brought ICD-11 online?
The WHO did.
Who did what?
Who brought the ICD-11 online? And reporting that story will be Mary Stanfill. She's also on the program, and that's who is going to be reporting our story.
But she's not on first. So who knew?
That's true. You know, we have much news reported. If we begin this morning with Dr. John Zellum. Dr. Zellum is at the Talk 10 Tuesday News Desk.
The Talk 10 Tuesday News Desk is brought to you by ICD University Bookstore, reminding you that February is National Heart Awareness Month. MedLearn Media is offering you a special four-pack. It's the 2022 Cardiology Billing and Compliance Set. Purchase in February and receive 20% off the bundle. That's $164 in savings. Now available at the ICD University Bookstore.
Here now is Dr. John Zellum.
Good morning, Chuck, and good morning, everybody. Very appropriate to this discussion is I'm going to talk a little bit today about documentation. And in my dealings in the world of clinical revenue cycle, many conversations center around physician documentation and the challenges associated with it. As you know, documentation is the cement, if you will, for the five components of clinical revenue cycle, because each of these components are looking at the same EMR, the same documentation, but they look at it through their own lens. Yet it is not just physician documentation that needs improvement, as this could also extend to nursing and other clinical areas, but today we're going to focus on the physician documentation, and the biggest complaints that I hear is the overuse and abuse of copy and paste, also termed cloning. There are other endearing terms that are used, but this is the most common one. A phrase that I commonly use when educating physicians and other caregivers is, the chart was surprised when the patient died. For example, a very acutely ill patient comes in and ends up with a four-day stay. The documentation goes as follows. Day one, H&P, plan of care done. Day two, info from day one, copy and pasted without editing. Day three, same information, copy and pasted without editing. Day four, patient dies. And I hear this all the time. Wow, didn't see that coming. Nothing was ever documented to indicate that the patient wasn't doing well. It was just copy and paste without edit. There certainly are some valid uses for copy and pasting, and even though many wish it would be eliminated, it does serve some purposes because clinicians find it is one of the only ways they can manage the nuances and demands of the documentation process. But there is that word that is missing in the phrase copy and paste, and that word is edit. It should be copy and paste and edit. Without editing, the capture of the true patient story and progress, or lack thereof, becomes sadly absent. In addition, the lack of editing will surely lead to denials and even lack of quality patient care and inaccurate patient demographics and data. Keep in mind that in addition to this practice leading to many problems on the medical side and patient care, trial attorneys are just as familiar with copy and paste without edit. In September of 2015, authors Ben Rubinowitz and Evan Torgan wrote an article in the New York Law Journal titled Attacking the Electronic Medical Record and concluded that once the trial lawyer has undermined the record and established that it is not worthy of belief, They can then argue that those errors in the record exemplify and define the lack of proper care and treatment rendered by the treating physician. That is all due to copy and paste without editing. Bottom line is that copy and paste is not going away, probably never will. But as with any technology, the uses and abuses need changing, starting with editing. But good luck to that. Education is the best route to take. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks very much, Dr. Sellum. That was Dr. John Sellum. Dr. Sellum is a former surgeon and today is the founder and the CEO of Streamline Solutions Consulting. It's Tuesday, it's February the 22nd, and you're listening to the 496th live edition of Talked In Tuesday. Stand by.
Coding for brain disorders comes with highly complex pathophysiological underpinnings that are difficult for non-clinicians to comprehend. Adding to the challenge, coders may not know where to turn for coding guidance or when to appropriately submit a physician query. Consequently, code assignments often come up short, potentially leading to claim denials or missed revenue opportunities. Correct, complete, and properly sequenced ICD-10 CM code assignments depend on solid pathophysiological and coding education. Exactly what you'll get from an ICD-10 Monitor webcast tomorrow, February 23rd. Kerry Greenwood will impart a clearer understanding of encephalopathy, cerebrovascular accident, and traumatic brain injury diagnosis. Real revenue is on the line. With the knowledge gained from this ICD-10 Monitor webcast, you'll achieve accurate coding and improved reimbursement.
Here now with the Talk to Tuesday Coding Report is Lori Johnson. Good morning, Lori.
Good morning, Chuck. Good morning, Erica, and hello to our listeners. While we are waiting for the tentative agenda for the ICD-10 PCS codes for the Coordination and Maintenance Committee meeting from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, I thought I would switch it up a little bit this morning. Usually we talk about ICD-10, but this morning I would like to review some new HCPCS codes. CMS released HCPCS codes for a drug and drug administration for the treatment of COVID-19 Omicron variant. The treatment is the bebtelovimab, which is authorized on February 11th by the Food and Drug Administration for emergency use to treat patients who are high risk to progress to severe COVID-19 or hospitalization. The patient must have a positive COVID-19 test to qualify. The drug is assigned Q022 with the description of injection bebtelovimab 175 milligrams. The administration of the medication is assigned M0222 intravenous injection bebtelovimab, including injection and post-administration monitoring, or M0223, intravenous injection bebtelovimab, including injection and post-administration monitoring in the home or residence. These three codes are effective February 11, 2022. The national payment rate for the three codes are as follows. M0222 pays $350.50. M0223 pays $550.50. And Q0222 is 1 cent. But remember that providers initially will not incur a charge or a cost for the product. The rates for the administration will be adjusted for a geographic location as well. This information can be found on the CMS website under Part B Drug Average Sales Price and select the COVID-19 vaccines and monoclonal antibodies. Another source is MLN Connects, which is dated February 18, 2022. And with that, Erica, and with all my stumbling through the medication, I will give it back to you.
Actually, Lori, you really impressed me. When you said it the first time, I was like, oh, my God, why did she pick this? Why did she pick this to talk about today? I can't pronounce it either. But you pulled it together, and you did great the next ones. That was Lori Johnson. Lori is a senior healthcare consultant at Revenue Cycle Solutions, LLC. Chuck?
Thanks, Erica, and that certainly is easy for you to say. And Lori Johnson, thanks again. I want to echo what Dr. Reamer just said about you and your skills in pronouncing those very difficult words. Our Tuesday focus today is about the FDA approval to the drug to treat patients with Alzheimer's. Here now with a cautionary tale about the coverage policy is the founder and CEO for Axia Solutions, Susan Gatehouse. Good morning, Susan. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Chuck, and good morning to all with a special welcome to Dr. Zellum. On January 11th of 2021, the FDA temporarily approved, for lack of a better word, national coverage, or temporarily approved the high profile drug Aduhelm for the treatment of patients with Alzheimer's disease. Later, a temporary national coverage decision was created, and we'll talk about that as we move through this segment. The coverage policy was met with some trepidation. It is temporary and has specific criteria for the use of Aduhelm. Alzheimer's disease is prevalent in the aging population. This prevalence is expected to rise to 14 million by 2060. Barring effective interventions such as lifestyle changes, treatment of risk factors, and possible combinations of Alzheimer's drugs, the concerns have been raised over the accelerated FDA approval of Aduhelm. The anticipation of its availability is certainly no surprise regarding the stats just mentioned. Aduhelm gained attention in 2021 as the first monoclonal antibody for treatment of Alzheimer's disease. The treatment gained attention relating to FDA approval process and the speed at which it gained momentum. The initial established list price for Aduhelm is $56,000, rising the Medicare premium by $22 for 2022. However, in December, this price was reduced by 50%. An FDA advisory panel did not recommend permanent approval of this drug as the risks related to the treatment had not been fully vetted. The Center for Clinical Standards and Quality with CMS suggested evidence of possible harmful side effects such as brain bleeds, headaches, dizziness, and falls. Biogen's drug, Aduhelm, has temporary coverage as of January the 11th for patients enrolled in an approved clinical trial, which must be conducted in the outpatient setting. Also consider the coverage would also include any conditions or any services related to the treatment with this particular drug. For example, PET scans are also included. However, it's important to read the coverage determination and the frequency in which PET scans can be conducted. Coverage policies do put some limitations to that. Effective January 1 of 2022, a HCPCS Level 2 code, J0172, was established for reporting the injection of Aduhelm, 2 milligrams. The dose descriptor 2 milligrams is the smallest dosage amount, allowing multiple units to accommodate a variety of doses, thus making the accuracy in reporting the dosage amount paramount. Revenue code 636 should be used when reporting these drugs. 636 is a reminder, is a revenue code to report drugs requiring detailed billing. So it should be used with J0172. The patient must be enrolled in an approved clinical trial and meet certain specific criteria to receive the new drug, such as the patient must have a clinical diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment due to Alzheimer's disease or mild Alzheimer's disease dementia, and an evidence of amyloid pathology consistent with Alzheimer's disease. In addition, the patient must not have any neurological or other secondary medical conditions that may significantly contribute to cognitive decline. Any medical conditions other than Alzheimer's disease may likely increase significant adverse events. Thus, the stipulations around this coverage decision or temporary coverage decision. Be aware the new code J0172 for the drug treatment is effective January 1, 2022 to March 31st, 2022, and subject to change during a 90-day comment period. Public comment is welcome until March 31st of 2022. Those organizations that treat high Alzheimer's disease Alzheimer's disease population should take note. We have 2 months to comment on this drug. links are provided for the clinical trial requirements, as well as what to implement or how to comment during the comment period. So with that said, back to you, Erica.
Thank you, Susan. That was founder and CEO for Axia Solutions, Susan Gatehouse. Chuck?
Thanks, Erica. And Susan Gatehouse, thanks very much. And be sure to read Susan's excellent article on the subject. It's in today's ICD-10 Monitor. We have great stories coming out next, but first is very important announcement.
Upon admission to a hospital, a patient presents with two conditions, each meeting the definition of a principal diagnosis. But which one should be coded as the principal diagnosis? Make the wrong choice and you'll end up with non-compliant ICD-10-CM and MS-DRG assignments, and that could create potential denial or reduced reimbursement. Also, the wrong or incorrectly sequenced ICD-10-CM code for the principal diagnosis is a common target for coding audits. Now, there's a webcast on this very topic. Florianne Bryant, one of America's leading coding and audit experts, will lead this important webcast. Join us on March 3rd for tips on improving your documentation and achieving compliant MS-DRG assignments.
The recent announcement that ICD-11 coding system went online as of February the 11th might have been met with some measured enthusiasm globally, but not here in the United States. That's because the coding set isn't expected to reach America's shores for a couple of years. Nonetheless, ICD-11 continues to be a topic generating keen interest among America's coding community, and that's why we've asked Mary Stanfield, our CDI-11 correspondent, to be our special guest today. And good morning, Mary.
Good morning, Chuck, and good morning, everyone. On February 11th, the World Health Organization released ICD-11 2022. This is the official version of the 11th revision of the International Classification of Diseases that WHO member countries will be implementing worldwide. In fact, according to the WHO, 35 countries are already using ICD-11. If you've heard me talk about this topic, you may recall the WHO began developing this 11th version of ICD in 2007. And they first released a preliminary version for evaluation and testing in 2016. And it was in May 2019 that the World Health Assembly adopted ICD-11 for implementation in 2022. Since releasing ICD-11 for testing, the WHO has received and processed 900 proposals, which represent input from early adopter countries, translators, and scientific groups. The 2022 version of ICD-11 posted online this month reflects these refinements. Some of the updates in the ICD-11 2022 version include rare disease coding, support for perinatal and maternal coding, grade and stage coding for cancers, updated diagnostic recommendations for mental health conditions, and codes for antimicrobial resistance based on the Global Antimicrobial Resistance and Use Surveillance System. Our listeners also may recall that ICD-11 is entirely digital with integrated API tools to facilitate implementation. And this 11th version of ICD was compiled and updated with input from over 90 countries, which represents unprecedented involvement of healthcare providers. So this version of ICD-11 is now available to us and is thoroughly scientifically updated and designed for use in a digital world. With this release of ICD-11 2022, the 11th version of ICD officially comes into effect, and the WHO is encouraging all member countries to move on to ICD-11. So what does that mean for us? Well, the WHO anticipates countries who have not used a previous version and have a fairly simple information system may need 1 to 2 years to implement ICD-11. In contrast, countries with highly sophisticated information systems, where earlier versions of ICD are already in use, may require 4 to 5 years to transition to ICD-11. And that certainly describes the U.S., where ICD-10-CM is, of course, embedded throughout our healthcare system. So when will the U.S. replace ICD-10-CM and begin using a version of ICD-11 for reporting on healthcare claims? Well, we don't know yet, but this release of the official ICD-11 is sure to spur activity in this respect. In September 2021, the NCVHS issued recommendations to the Secretary of HHS advising on a research agenda to evaluate the use of ICD-11 in the U.S. This release of the official ICD-11 2022 version from the WHO is sure to increase research activity. So while the timeline for a U.S. transition to IC-11 has not yet been determined, it's clear that planning for the transition to IC-11 is underway. And one thing is certain, it's imperative to monitor IC-11 planning now that the official version of IC-11 has been released. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Mary, very much. That was Mary Stanfield. Mary is the Vice President of Consulting Services for United Audit Systems. And be sure to read Mary's excellent article on the very latest on ICD-11. It's on the ICD-10 Monitor website. You can read it today. Now it's time for a very popular segment here at Talk 10 Tuesday. It's called Talk Back, and it features our very own Dr. Erica Reamer. Dr. Reamer, it's all yours.
Thanks, Chuck. A physician advisor asked me a question regarding Section 2H from the ICD-10-CM Official Guidelines for Coding and Reporting, which states, if the diagnosis documented at the time of discharge is qualified as probable, suspected, likely, questionable, probable, or still to be ruled out, compatible with, consistent with, or other similar terms indicating certain uncertainty, code the condition as if it existed or was established. This is only for inpatient admissions on the technical side of billing. Professional billing and outpatient services do not follow this rule. Dr. Jack Sublett wanted to know, if the uncertain diagnosis were not present in the discharge summary or the progress note on the day of discharge, is it against the guidelines to code it? He included a caveat that the condition under question is valid and backed up with solid clinical indicators. I remember when I was a physician advisor, we had a specific list of what we considered to be bona fide uncertain diagnoses. Concern for was not included. And I was glad when Coding Clinic came out in 2018, quarter one, with advice indicating that concern for was acceptable as an uncertain diagnosis phrase. I try to get providers to use as strong uncertain diagnosis words as their incertitude allows. My article lists a myriad of examples of words conveying uncertainty. Coders are permitted to use their discretion as to whether another, quote, similar term, close quote, indicates uncertainty. Coding Clinic 2014, quarter one, established that evidence of does not indicate uncertainty and can be coded as definitive. The condition must be present as an uncertain diagnosis at the time of discharge or demise. Obviously, it is optimal to include it in the discharge summary in uncertain form, since providers often have a window during which they can generate said discharge summary, and coders might want to get a jump on coding the encounter. Tradition is that if the uncertain diagnosis appears in the last progress note, the condition may be picked up. What happens if the final progress note has the condition documented in an uncertain format, and then the formally pending discharge summary completely sidesteps the condition? It wasn't ruled out. It wasn't ruled in. It doesn't appear at all. If the coding has been done and the bill has already been dropped, I doubt folks are even going to check the errant discharge summary to see if the condition was maintained in the documentation. If an auditor happens to review that record, they could remove the uncertain diagnosis since it did not materialize in the discharge summary. If this is a regular occurrence, I would advise the facility to encourage more prompt discharge summary completion and or to withhold coding of records until the discharge summary is available. Dr. Sublett also submitted that the condition was valid and backed up with solid clinical indicators. If that is the case, the ball should be in the CDI team's court to query. Perhaps the diagnosis isn't even uncertain anymore. I recommend getting the provider to evolve, resolve, remove, recap. The most important aspect is to recap all pertinent and relevant diagnoses in the discharge summary. I also suggest marrying uncertain diagnoses with definitive signs or symptoms like chest pain, probable acute gastritis, or anemia, possibly chronic iron deficiency. Since on the professional side, one can only code to the highest degree of certainty, this structure gives the professional coder something to code. The inpatient technical coder can pick up the uncertain diagnosis if it is still present at the time of discharge or demise. There are exceptions to the uncertain diagnosis rule, which prohibit the coding of that condition from an uncertain format. These include HIV, Zika, novel influenza, and COVID-19. The coder would be obligated to pick up the definitive symptoms of cough and fever, for instance, for the rule-out COVID-19 case. I hope this clears up your uncertainty about uncertain diagnoses. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Erica, very much. And be sure to read her excellent article on this very important topic is in today's ICD-10 Monitor. Erica, let's take a look at some of the questions that are coming in, a number of questions about ICD-11. Let's tackle those first.
First, I really quickly want to let Lori Johnson, you had a comment about my talk back. You want to just make it yourself?
Sure. You were talking about codes that are diagnoses that might have been missed in the discharge summary. And my plea as someone who writes appeal letters is, especially if that diagnosis is going to affect your DRG or APR-DRG assignment, you want to make sure that the documentation is crystal clear.
Yeah, we don't want to, you know, get it jumped into a different and lower weighted DRG just because somebody left it out. Agreed. Thank you, Lori. Okay, so ICD-11. Chuck wants to talk about ICD-11. So, Mary, we have two questions. I'm not sure which one to do, which order to do it in. Where can you get training certification for ICD-11? I guess where can you get training and certification, I would imagine.
Sure. Well, there is, in fact, I can tell you that there is quite a bit of training available. If you look on the internet, AHIMA has a series of three free ICD-11 webinars that they've made available to folks, and so you can check on their website. You also can check the International Federation of Health Information Management Association's website, IFHEMA. They also have some training available there. And the WHO themselves have a free coding browser, coding tool, and some training that's free also that is a good introduction to ICD-11. So lots of great information that's available if you look around. Honestly, I would say that's maybe one of the best ways to get started. I see that's kind of a couple questions here too, Erica. Folks want to know how should they be preparing? Well, I would say do just that. Start to get familiar with it and start to look at what the codes look like, how they're organized. You'll find a lot of similarities there, as well as, of course, some of those differences that really make ICD-11 an exceptional ICD system. So I would start there with that information.
Mary, I have a question for you. How long, in terms of a period of time, do we have to prepare for ICD-11 when it ultimately arrives here in the United States?
Well, I mean, it is available now to all the WHO member countries. So it's arrived. I would say we have the official, ICD-11 2022 version. ICD-11 is available now for implementation, which means we need to get busy, right? And I believe we can probably look to NCVHS and other policymakers to start to disseminate communication, as they've talked about, if you read their recommendations from the NCVHS on how we would begin that implementation to ICD-11. So it starts with really investigating what the implications are, what changes we'll have to make in our infrastructure in terms of the technology, the tools, all that sort of thing. And we don't have a timeline yet, Chuck. As I said, WHO even recognizes that it'll take 4 to 5 years. And of course, in the U.S., we have to update all of our tooling, our CAC coding encoder tools and things like that. And, I forgot to mention, I knew there was one other thing because folks asked about what should we be doing to prepare. The AHIMA has, if they have not yet, they will be. I believe they have already, but if not, it will shortly be available, an implementation guide, which really incorporated some of the lessons learned from the transition from ICD-10 when we moved to ICD-10-CM and built some of those lessons learned and really identifies kind of things to think about, a checklist, if you will, for implementation planning. So that guide also will be very helpful.
Very good. That's going to be a wrap for our 496 live edition of Talk 10 Tuesday. I want to thank our panelists today. Susan Gatehouse, Lori Johnson, Dr. John Zellum, and Mary Stanfield, who was reporting our lead story this morning and answering a number of questions on ICD-11. And, of course, our special thanks to our co-host, Dr. Erica Reamer. And remember, you can listen to all the Talk 10 Tuesday podcasts on Stitcher, Apple, Spotify, and Google Play. And when you do, give us a review. Rate us. Until next Tuesday, I'm Chuck Buck, reporting for ICD-10 Monitor Talk 10 Tuesday. Thank you very much, everybody. Have a wonderful week.
Talk 10 Tuesday is a production of ICD-10 Monitor.